The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon. My name is Hadar Harris, and I'm the Executive Director of the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law. I want to welcome all of you here, all of the many of you here today. It's a very important discussion that we're going to be having this afternoon. I think the very fact that we have Room 602 full today on a Friday afternoon really shows how important the beginning of this discussion is. And what we're going to be doing today is really just starting a discussion that will have many, many levels and many different repercussions over time. So I want to thank you all for coming. A couple of things, just briefly before we get started, I want to say special thank you to the Student Advisory Board of the Center for Human Rights, who really pulled this whole event together. Can those of you who are here raise your hands, please? Lauren and Tim and Craig and Olivia and Teresa. I want to say a special thank you to them for inviting our speakers and really pulling this thing together. Also to Colin and to Monica. Colin, who is in charge of our technology and helped to hook up this very high-tech speakerphone that we have here today, and Monica, who also helped us put this together. We really couldn't be doing this without them. There are a lot of different levels that we can talk about what has happened in the Gulf states in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Today, we're going to be talking about the human rights implications of Hurricane Katrina on a variety of different levels. We could talk about it in terms of the preparation or lack of preparation for this enormous emergency that was anticipated and which, at least for 72 hours, people knew was going to hit. We could talk about it in terms of the immediate crisis of what happened when the storm came and immediately following in terms of rescuing people and in terms of securing areas. And we can talk about it in terms of the aftermath of what is happening now. The human rights implications are very broad. When we think about basic and fundamental human rights, we think first and foremost about maintaining safety and security of person, about the right to health, the right to shelter and housing, education, food, culture. We also think about legal obligations that we have as a country and as a country in terms of the treatment of internally displaced peoples. We're going to hear from a variety of speakers today about different perspectives in terms of race, in terms of class, in terms of identity. And we have a very special guest on the phone, Libby Carden, who's going to talk about what she personally went through and what her organization is doing to help the situation down in the South. And I'll introduce her in just a second. It's clear that there has to be thorough and systematic documentation of what has gone on and what continues to go on in the wake of this disaster, not only by journalists, and you see stories starting to come out. The Post had a very comprehensive report, I think, just yesterday about what was going on in the Superdome, but also by lawyers, and we have very specific roles to play in this process. There are going to be lawsuits, no question, but beyond those lawsuits, we have to find truth, and it is our job to try to help find truth, because in finding truth, we will try to make sense of what happened so that it won't happen again, so we can get to the core of a variety of issues that have been left festering. The hurricane ripped off the roof of the Superdome, but it obviously and quite clearly has also ripped off the top of some covered up issues and has exposed truths in terms of the divides within this country, in terms of race, in terms of class, in terms of how we relate to the sense of community and the responsibilities we have towards one another. So we can seize this opportunity to get to the core of some of these issues and to build a better future. Today, we're going to take a first step in trying to start to understand what has happened. And after our speakers are finished, have about half an hour where we as a community can talk about what we can do and what role we can play heading out from this moment. So, with that brief introduction, or long introduction, I want to introduce our first speaker. Monique Hardin is one of the co-founders, and I don't even know, Monique, your official title, but one of the key gurus of environmental advocates for human rights. Monique, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, all right. Her organization, her nonprofit organization, is based in New Orleans. They do a great deal of extraordinary work on issues of environmental racism, on environmental justice, and on environmental human rights. We've just started working together, sort of, right? Just before the hurricane struck. And when I told Monique that we were having this panel, she called to give me a kind of report from the ground, and I said, let's do one better, and invited her to participate by phone with us. She's currently in Birmingham, Alabama, in a hotel room where she's camped out with her family. Her associates have been scattered, and she'll tell us a little bit more about that. She's going to speak for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then we'll have about 10 minutes for questions with her, and then we'll go on to our other panelists. So with that said, Monique, we're really pleased to have you here and look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you, Dara. As Dara said, my name is Monique Hardin, and I grew up and live in New Orleans, Louisiana, where my organization, Advocates for Environmental Human Rights, is based. And I think it's important to understand that Katrina was not just a hurricane, it's a human rights crisis. Hurricane Katrina has exposed and really brought into sharp focus the injustice, many injustices that have been harming the lives of African Americans and poor people, not just in the city of New Orleans, but also in the Gulf Coast communities. Although my family and I were able to evacuate before Katrina made landfall, many people, as you know, were not so fortunate. There were not and never have been local resources to evacuate the entire city. So we're now hearing on the news the reports of the warnings to our federal government for emergency evacuation that were completely ignored. And as a result, our friends who were trapped in the city had to wade and swim in flood waters. Some waters being 5 feet or higher. And they did this in order to find food and water. And we know for a fact that they're now suffering from burns and skin rashes because the flood water contained toxic chemicals. African American neighborhoods, where my organization, Advocates for Environmental Human Rights, has been working, these neighborhoods are the places where companies have abandoned massive amounts of contaminated waste, and it's these neighborhoods that are now underwater. There are other neighborhoods in New Orleans and in the surrounding parishes where oil refineries and petrochemical facilities are operating, and that these neighborhoods and communities are now a virtual toxic dump. People who've been struggling to improve public schools, clean up their environment, reform inhumane prison conditions are now either dead or displaced in cities as far away from New Orleans as Washington, D.C., and Salt Lake City, Utah. Friends I've talked to who were rescued on Friday, 4 days after the hurricane struck, have told me how they were lied to by rescue workers, how they had guns and rifles pointed at them, and how they were separated from their children and family members. Some of them are still searching for their family members to this day. And while the media attempts now to portray this nightmare as somehow being over, the reality is that displaced residents are still having a hell of a time finding assistance, housing, and medical care. The future does not bode well as the Bush administration, Caldwell in particular, is organizing teams of conservative think tanks, GOP lawmakers, to make the rebuilding of New Orleans and Gulf Coast communities somehow be a shining vision of conservative values and ideology. And this is now taking place with the awarding of multi-million dollar contracts to Halliburton while workers are paid less than the prevailing wage, and in securing a place for developers and businesses in the rebuilding without any participation of residents who have been displaced about the future of their homes, their neighborhoods, and their cities. The places where rebuilding is needed is not in the neighborhoods that were not flooded, where residents are mostly white and affluent, but in the neighborhoods that you saw on TV, where the water was up to the rooftops of homes. These are the neighborhoods where mostly African-American, poor and working class people live. What our organization is now focused on doing, and what we need the help of everyone in doing, is demanding that displaced residents be made whole and able to return their to their cities and able to participate in the design, planning, and implementation of rebuilding New Orleans and Gulf Coast communities. What we're seeing right now is the seeds being planted for making this area that was hit by Hurricane Katrina in the aftermath of floodwaters. It's this kind of uber gentrification plan. The city of New Orleans is about 65% African American, and many of the Gulf Coast communities that were hit the hardest are also predominantly African American. The displacement of people of color, my family, my neighbors, my friends, creates major political ramifications in terms of what the city will look like, in terms of the impact we can have in political leadership of our city and our communities. And that's all I have at this point. I'm really open for questions.
That's great. Thank you, Monique. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Just briefly, because we have three other speakers who are going to get deeper into some of the many issues that Monique raised. Are there, because she only has a very limited amount of time to share with us, are there specific questions that people would like to ask at this point of her before she's going to have to go?
My question for Monique, having been down there, I know that they are, can you hear me? Is that all right?
I actually can hear you.
Okay, great. I know that they're starting to send people back to their homes. And if it is the equivalent of a toxic waste site, like three Superfund sites flooded, toxic disposal facilities flooded, docks destroyed, as well as all the household waste and gas stations, how can the people responsible for sending the citizens back to their houses not take that into account when they say that we're going to send you back there? Aren't these perhaps ramifications that will be felt for many, 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 many years afterward and will be difficult for us to put our finger on as people maybe start to die in the future?
My understanding, and I'm still trying to, the information that I have is kind of spotty, but what I do know is that they're allowing people to return to those areas that were not flooded. And right now the mayor has announced plans kind of on a zip code by zip code basis. And this, of course, should pertain to the city of New Orleans. A kind of a schedule of when people can come back. What I don't know at this point in time is if people will be allowed to come back for a short period of time to maybe recover personal items and that sort of thing, or if it will be, you know, you can now come back and return to your city permanently. There is a major concern with regards to the toxic contamination issues, which is not helped by our Environmental Protection Agency not being transparent and forthcoming with where they're actually doing their water sampling, what exactly they're testing for, and what these results show, and an analysis of whether or not chemicals detected exceed or create public health concerns. This is right now is part of the mystery that shouldn't be a mystery. Everyone should have this information. It should be publicly available, and it's not. And my organization, as well as those of others that are concerned about this, are having to file Freedom of Information Act requests for EPA, which will, you know, create a situation where we won't be able to get that information quickly. So I'm deeply concerned about what the return means at this point in time. I'm also concerned about without a proper and effective environmental plan for the city, that we could be returning back to a place that would create public health problems that could be avoided with, you know, proper planning.
Let me follow up on that, because, you know, on one hand, you think about that and this tremendous toxic contamination that, you know, as you said, we don't know what it is, where it is, how much it is, and really what the urgent dangers are. On the other hand, there's extraordinary political pressure to get people back. right?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
How do we balance that out? Because on one hand, you can say, well, we're going to keep people from going back because it's a safety issue, but there's not a lot of credibility on all sides, right?
Right. Let me just back. This really goes, harkens back to the 9/11 situation, where people were very concerned about air quality after the Twin Towers came down, and the air was engulfed in clouds of dust and particles, and there were still burning embers days after the attack. And EPA was there on the spot as the authority expert on this matter, saying the air was fine and people should not be concerned. And then later on, a couple of years later, EPA confessed that, well, that really wasn't true, but we did that because we didn't want anyone to panic. And there was political pressure, obviously, on the agency at the time to say, we've recovered, we snapped back into position, and the attack didn't, stop the American spirit and the American way of life, and all that kind of gung-ho stuff. And that, we're seeing it right here happening before our very eyes. The mayor seems to be saying two things at the same time. One, there is a public health issue, and there may be hazards related to coming back. But yes, you can come back. And so it's definitely something that's driven by politics, not by facts and science at this point.
Great, thanks.
Hi, Monique. I just graduated from Loyola, New Orleans, and from Lafayette, Louisiana. My question for you is, all the displaced evacuees are in cities all over Louisiana, like Lafayette. Many of those cities are unable to accommodate such a large influx of people. And what do you foresee the consequences of that on those cities as well as the state of Louisiana as a whole?
Well, your 4 years in attending college in Louisiana, that we are a very poor state, and there are very few resources to handle a disaster like this one, and where cities are inundated with people some of whom can't support themselves and find new houses or lease apartments have some sort of way of adapting with very little problem. But then there are going to be, a great need for the folks who have been, who may have been in poor situation prior to Hurricane Katrina and now are really devastated because they don't have anywhere with all to deal with issues of finding housing and jobs and medical assistance and care. So yeah, this is a huge burden, and I think what it calls for is not for cities like Lafayette and many other small towns around Louisiana to figure it out, but it really calls for a sensitive federal program that can meet the needs of evacuees from New Orleans and Gulf Coast communities. Nothing less can happen, because the reality is that these cities don't have the resources to ably deal with all the folks, just from a size number. And then when you look at the various issues that folks are bringing, who, just look at the issue of look at the situation this way. For most cities, you have about a 5 or perhaps 10% vacancy rate in just rental property. And if you have the population doubled, like Baton Rouge, you're talking about this great housing need that the city is not able to furnish or provide at all. And that's what's happening around the state, and as well as the cities outside of the state. And there's a need for a major federal program.
What do you see as being the biggest discrepancy between what is actually happening on the ground there and what we're hearing about on the news?
You hear that?
And at the beginning, what are the biggest
discrepancy between what we're hearing about in the news and what's happening on the ground?
I think the biggest discrepancy is that everyone is evacuated and everyone is in a shelter and receiving assistance. That's not happening. There are many people who are still in New Orleans in need and surrounding parishes and rural communities who are still in need of basic things like food and water and housing, where Red Cross is not delivering any services, FEMA certainly is missing in action, and you have volunteer citizens, you know, buying stuff and bringing it in by the carloads to folks in these situations who they can find. So I think the biggest discrepancy is that the problem is now over, and it's not.
On that note, Moody, I'm gonna. I know that you have to go to your next phone call, and we're gonna move on to our other panelists. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us. I also just want to make people aware that, particularly as for what Moody just said, we've developed a resource list of places taking donations, and among those places on the second page are organizations that the U.S. Human Rights Network has identified as providing direct aid and assistance to some of these people who aren't getting it from the more established or big-name charities who are holding telethons on TV. So, Monique, thank you very much for joining us. And, of course, we wish you and your family and your colleagues, your friends and your community, all the best. And you and I will be back in touch to see what we can do next together.
I look forward to it. Thank you all.
Thanks a lot, Monique.
Bye-bye.
We've got a high-tech moment. Exactly. So with that little dose of reality, or big dose of reality, I suppose, we're going to now turn to three of our esteemed WCL professors who are going to talk to us about some of the specific aspects of, dive a little bit deeper into some of the things that we just talked about. Angela, you can go first. First we'll hear from Professor Angela Davis, then Professor Susan Bennett, and finally Professor Munir Rai.
Thanks, Adar. Thanks to you and to Tim and to all of the co-sponsoring organizations for having this and for inviting me to speak. I've been asked to talk about the issue of crime and lawlessness. Lawlessness, in quotes or out of quotes, however you see it. The tragic aftermath of Katrina has laid bare the race and class disparities in this country like no other event in recent history. We know that this country is very divided around issues of race, and that there have been other events in recent history that have demonstrated that divide. The Simpson verdict, for example, demonstrated how divided we are in this nation and our perceptions of race, racism, and fairness in the criminal justice system. But the aftermath of Katrina revealed these issues in such stark ways that it has been impossible to ignore. The day before the levees broke and the city of New Orleans flooded, we were overwhelmed with images on the day after the levees broke and the city of New Orleans flooded. We were overwhelmed with images on television and in the news that revealed that almost all of the people left behind, on rooftops, floating on pieces of furniture, and swimming and drowning in the toxic ocean of water, oil, feces, and dead bodies, were black and poor. And then the questions rose. Why didn't they leave? Well, the mayor issued a mandatory evacuation order, but almost 100,000 people in the city of New Orleans were so poor that they had neither a car nor enough money to even take a Greyhound bus out of the town. Or if they did, they didn't have anywhere to go, or money to stay in a hotel, or start a new life. And yes, there were those who chose to stay and weather the storm, but the tens of thousands of people who were herded into the Superdome and into the convention center, and those that did make it to either, wanted to leave, but they couldn't. We saw the images on television starting on that Tuesday, August 30th, and by Wednesday, some members of the media began to state the obvious because it was too obvious to ignore it. Almost all of these folks were black and poor, and why wouldn't the government help them? Could these two phenomena have something to do with each other? The black and poor part and the part about the government not helping them. The images were on every network, even Fox News. And the media somehow managed to get there. They walked around the convention center and around the Superdome, and even Harry Connick Jr. was there walking around. And none of the people were harming them or trying to kill them or hurt them. So where was the government? Hadar mentioned in her remarks the lack of preparation, but I questioned whether it was a lack of preparation. Was it a lack of preparation, or was it a lack of will? Was it benign neglect, or was it malign neglect? Be that as it may, Bush decided to end his 6-week vacation early and fly over the poor black people. But Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday went by before the National Guard was finally called in, and then it was too late. Too many people had died. Too many people had seen and experienced too much. The harm had been done, and it could not be undone, and it cannot be undone. And so I was asked to talk about crime, and so I want to talk about the issue of harm. I talk about harm and harm not being undone, because the harm principle is one that has a lot to do with the criminal law. So let's talk about harm. You know from your criminal law class, if you took it from me, or if you took it from Reverend Robinson or Jones and any of the folks in here, that in our society, we deem certain behaviors to be so unacceptable that we call them crimes, and we punish people who engage in those behaviors. So when I say we, really, I mean our state legislators and our Congress decide which behaviors and acts are crimes. And they say that they call them crimes because they're unacceptable, because they're immoral, a number of different reasons. But one of the main reasons they cite is because they're harmful, because these behaviors cause harm. But there are degrees of harm, and we punish them accordingly. For example, murders, rapes, and robberies are violent crimes that harm people. So we punish them much more harshly than we do property crimes, like theft and destruction of property, for example. Some have suggested there are some behaviors that shouldn't be crimes at all because they don't cause harm at all, like possession of marijuana, for example, some people think. But at looking at the issue of lawlessness in the aftermath of Katrina, we have to examine the harm principle. There was much focus on the lawlessness of the victims of Katrina. They're looting, they're stealing. They're stealing food and clothes and televisions. And of course, some of us made distinctions between the types of property. Some of us say, well, it's okay to steal food, but it's not okay to steal clothes. Or it's okay to steal clothes if you're naked and don't have clothes, but only certain kind of clothes, but not designer tennis shoes or suits, but maybe basic and expensive shirts and pants, as if the people wading through the swamp were supposed to keep waiting until they found appropriate clothes to cover their bodies. Not too expensive, of course. And it's never okay to steal televisions. But let's look at this so-called looting through the lens of the harm principle. Whether it's food or clothes or televisions, it's property. And many times property from huge retail conglomerates that were going to file insurance claims for this property at any rate, most of which was damaged beyond use by the flood. So who was harmed? What was the harm? Let's compare this so-called looting with the deaths of hundreds of people in hospitals and nursing homes, or even in their own homes. When a person's negligence causes the death of another, they are guilty of what crime, my students? Huh? Or what's another term for it? Involuntary manslaughter. What the hell, my students? Okay, it was just high spring.
I want you to know that my students answered the question.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay, let me say that again. When a person's negligence causes the death of another, they're guilty of involuntary manslaughter. And some states say ordinary negligence, and some say, you know, extreme negligence, and some say recklessness. But you get the point. If they fail to exercise the ordinary caution that a person of reasonable prudence would exercise under the same or similar conditions, they act negligently. So, who was responsible for rescuing the people who died because they couldn't hold on any longer? How about the critically sick people in the hospitals who the doctors and nurses helplessly watched die because no one showed up? Did the persons responsible for rescuing them act negligently? Perhaps recklessly? If so, they are guilty of involuntary manslaughter. If they acted extremely recklessly, they might be guilty of the more serious crime of second-degree murder, right, under an extreme recklessness theory. But no one's talking about that because we're worried about the televisions that got stolen from Walmart, okay? Or if we're worried about looting, let's talk about Halliburton. Let's talk about Bechtel or some of the other Republican-linked firms that are lining up to get the no-bid contracts that will surely come as a result of the $62 billion that Congress has appropriated to rebuild the Gulf Coast. And there's no talk, as Monique pointed out, about involving the residents of New Orleans and the other Gulf port areas in that rebuilding process in terms of community and economic development, as Professor Bennett, I'm sure, will talk about. And I'm not trying to ignore the harder cases, because I know that there were allegations that some people were assaulting people, even raping people, pointing guns at people. Certainly police and law enforcement must protect people against violent behavior. But how widespread was this violent behavior, really? How many people really did engage in that type of behavior? And let me step out here and say, might there be a reason not to prosecute, perhaps, in even some of these cases? There were allegations that some people threatened to kill some of the rescuers if they weren't rescued first. How awful, and we all cringed at that. Not exactly admirable behavior and perhaps criminal, but might a person in the convention center who's been held up without food or water, living in filth and squalor and watching people drop dead around him, believe that he will die too if he isn't rescued immediately? Should we judge his behavior differently under the circumstances? I don't know. I want to pull up an image. Yeah, many of you probably have seen this. This email got sent all over the world. Two media reports, the top one from Associated Press, says, and it's accompanying this picture of a black man on the top, a young man walks through chest-deep flood water after looting a grocery store in New Orleans on Tuesday, August 30th. Flood waters continue to rise at 7. Okay, that was on August 30th. Same day, another report, picture down here to white people. Two residents wade through chest deep water after finding bread and soda from a local grocery store after Hurricane Katrina came through the area in New Orleans, Louisiana. Okay? These pictures and their captions epitomize the racial disparities in the criminal justice system. There's little doubt that people of color, both the accused and victims of crime, are treated differently at every stage of the criminal process, from arrest to prosecution, at trial, at sentencing, and in the implementation of the death penalty. Time does not permit me to cite for you the numerous studies and reports that have documented this fact. I can tell you about them later. Some of you are taking Professor Jones' race, crime, and politics class, so if you are, you'll learn about this. But this photograph epitomizes the phenomenon that forms the basis for not only the overall poor treatment of the 100,000 residents that were abandoned in New Orleans, but for the stark disparities that exist at every stage of the criminal justice system. And that phenomenon is called unconscious racism. Professor Charles Lawrence's seminal law review article called The Id, the Ego, and Equal Protection, Reckoning with Unconscious Racism, the Stanford Law Review, I can give you the site if you're interested, describes the phenomenon as follows, and I'm quoting from the article. If I can turn this page. Americans share a common historical and cultural heritage in which racism has played and still plays a dominant role. Because of this shared experience, we also inevitably share many ideas, attitudes, and beliefs that attach significance to an individual's race and induce negative feelings and opinions about non-whites. To the extent that this cultural belief system has influenced all of us, we are all racist. At the same time, most of us are unaware of our racism. We do not recognize the ways in which our cultural experience has influenced our beliefs about race or the occasions on which those beliefs affect our actions. In other words, a large part of the behavior that produces racial discrimination is influenced by unconscious racial motivation. One unconscious, and that's the end of the quote, one unconscious phenomenon that contributes to or forms the basis of this unconscious racism is the association of crime with black and brown people. Professor Catherine Russell writes about it in her book called The Color of Crime. It is that association and these unconscious beliefs that result in this caption, for example, these captions here, that and also that cause so many to care more about black people stealing televisions than about white people causing the death of black lives through their neglect. And because these beliefs are unconscious, they are so difficult to eliminate or even to address. So, where does that lead us? Out of the tragedy of Katrina comes some hope, I hope. First, it truly shows the humanity of most Americans. Despite the government's failures, the generosity of most individual Americans has been overwhelming, giving money, opening their homes, and offering all kinds of assistance to total strangers, oftentimes people of a different race, cultural background. And we can only hope that this country's realization that so many of our brothers and sisters live in abject, poverty will spark some long-lasting solutions. Hopefully we won't lose interest in a few months when the media moves on to the next story, but we'll affirm our commitment to ending poverty in this country. Let's stop declaring war on other countries. Let's declare war on poverty and racism in this country, and let's start that war right here at the Washington College of Law. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon to everybody. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great, thank you. I'm Susan Bennett, and I direct our Community Economic Development Clinic here at the school, and I've been asked to talk about Katrina and what happened in the Gulf and what happened in New Orleans, and economic development, and about poverty. And I want to start by talking about another big city, another big American city, that in the event of natural disaster can expect to be cut off from all chance of outside relief, can expect to be isolated from the world and external resources for between 2 and 3 days. Let me tell you about San Francisco's disaster relief plan. You know about San Francisco. It's this gorgeous city by the bay. It is well-schooled in disaster. It has been rebuilt after the earthquakes in 1906 from the ground up and the earthquake of 1999. I don't know if any of you heard, the other day there was an interview on NPR with the mayor of San Francisco, Gavin Newsom. And he talked about what his disaster plan is for the residents of the city of San Francisco. I'm oversimplifying this by more than a little bit, but the bottom line is, it's everybody should learn CPR and everybody should have a buddy. Because when the big one hits, the residents of San Francisco can expect to be cut off from the world for 2 to 3 days with no chance of assistance from the outside world. And why is that? How is it that the mayor of one of the richest cities and populaces of the world, let alone the United States, knows already that his constituents may face the same fate as did those of the poorest residents of one of the poorest cities in America? The answer is, when the bridges come down and the tunnels collapse, San Francisco will be geographically cut off. And over half of its first responders, the people who are fire people, the people who are police people, the EMT technicians, they live on the other side of those bridges and tunnels. They live on the other side because they can't afford to live in San Francisco. I'm not exaggerating that point because I've heard it from the mayor himself. We all heard it from the mayor himself. And while I will cry, I imagine that the residents of San Francisco, wealthy as they have to be, do have resources that I will talk about, the ones that are obvious and the ones that are less obvious, to weather the 2 to 3 days before serious help and the first responders can reach them. But I guess there's a moral here, or maybe it raises a question, which is, how do you construct who lives in your city? When persons are dispersed, as they have been in New Orleans, residents scattered across 49 states and districts of Columbia, who gets to come back? Who gets to decide who gets to come back? And for the rest of our cities, the District of Columbia, Boston, Chicago, Newark, the ones that have experienced smaller diasporas of poor people and poor black people over time, who makes the decisions about who lives in those cities who gets to stay, who has to leave. These are questions of structural poverty, these are questions of structural racism, these are questions of economic development, and they go back a long way. And what is wondrous to me is how when every disaster strikes, we look at them like they do. Hurricanes don't create disasters, people do. It's like a giant mountain. We create our own weather. We create our own microclimates, we create our own macroclimates. And San Francisco and New Orleans present two strange images, really mirror images, inverse images of American inequality. And again, they are not new because we have seen these models of inequality here in other parts of the world for many, many years. One image of inequality is San Francisco. It is one in which the poor, San Francisco of today, is one in which the poor and the less poor, and even the middle class, live on the periphery from the central city. They live away from the core of wealth and influence and opportunity. In some ways, this is an old model that describes the great European cities of the 19th century, which were specifically engineered in terms of their street grid, their housing pattern, even their transportation flow, to keep the poor, who everyone knew were rabble-rousers, the rabble-rousing laborers, out of the core city and away from the seat of government, and away from their ability to cause trouble. The model which scatters poor people away from sources of opportunity, from sources of jobs, and from sources of influence and credit, is a model which increasingly describes this city in which we are right now, the District of Columbia. It increasingly describes New York City, it increasingly describes Boston. And that is not all attributable to market forces which have raised the cost of housing. In the other model, which is New Orleans and some of the other cities, the poorer cities, the cities that have remained poor in this city, the very poor and the less poor live concentrated in the inner core of the city. It is an inner core from which better educated persons, those with assets and wealth, as well as income, because those are different things, have fled. And in the wake of those who fled the core of the cities, businesses and opportunities have fallen. And that describes a great many American cities, particularly during the 50s and 60s, when a combination of white flight, federal transportation systems, which encouraged the dispersion of people from the core, which discouraged the use of public transportation, made living in the suburbs financially and in terms of opportunities infinitely more attractive to those who, again, had the cars and the means to leave. These are both very old models, and as I've said, they didn't happen accidentally. I think it's safe to say, although it's very hard to generalize about these things because they're very complicated, that our urban history has been one of fostering either great concentrations of wealth or great concentrations of poverty, and not a great deal of mix of incomes and of cultures and of ethnicities in between. 50 years ago, Michael Harrington wrote a book called The Other America. It was about the abject poverty that had been hidden, as the poverty in New Orleans was hidden, deep in the Delta. And the wonder to me is that it does seem to take a great disaster. The Dust Bowls and the great westward migrations of impoverished farmers in the 1930s, Katrina and the great diaspora of the residents of New Orleans today to make people rediscover poverty. I want to talk a little bit about how we think about causes of inequality, how we respond to inequality, and how we respond to disaster. And how we seem to do it the same way in every generation when inequality is rediscovered. Again, going back to, and Monique absolutely mentioned this, the question of who gets to return to New Orleans is a question of whoever gets to return to any great American city once wealth becomes reconcentrated and poverty becomes reconcentrated there. Who got to return after the urban renewals in DC, Boston, Chicago in the 1950s, who gets to return to DC, Boston, Chicago, and New Orleans after the urban renewal of today? An anecdote. Those of you who read the Wall Street Journal, and I actually highly recommend it, because it, for those of you who identify themselves with kind of lefty liberal economics, it's good to see how people different from you think and write. And it's a remarkable window into many things. And there's actually some excellent reporting that goes on in the journal. There was an article last week that was circulated to me, a feature about some interviews with members of some of the older families who lived in New Orleans for a long time, well-off, secure, primarily white, who live upground, and therefore are in a good way to be able to return. They're able to get out, and they will be able to return. And they have been conferring about, and they're quite unabashed about this, how Katrina has accomplished what New Orleans' very slow pace of the demolition of public housing projects has not. As Monique noted, they envision a new city. It will be one without poor people. In the 1950s, this very same view of how you reconstruct a city was called urban renewal, and those who were displaced by urban renewal called it Negro removal. I think that concentrations of poverty are bad. Everyone agrees. Persons who live in concentrations of poverty look for ways to enrich their lives, literally with income, with assets, with resources, with education, with opportunity for themselves and their children, with better housing conditions, with safety and security. I think why poverty gets concentrated and what to do about it, nobody agrees with, and that's where the great ideological divides occur. We know, for instance, that a combination of redlining, credit and the extension of discrimination in the extension of both commercial and residential credit, restrictive covenants, which were enforceable before 1948 and allowed the sellers of homes to restrict, which required the sellers of homes to restrict who the buyers of their homes would be, to restrict out buyers who were, depending on your neighborhood, black or Catholic or Jewish. We know that discrimination in urban renewal, which forced persons who were black and poor primarily out of sections of cities into segregated public housing projects. We know that this has been, these many factors, and they're very complicated, have been responsible over time, for at least the last 50 years, and some of them even longer, for the concentration of poverty in the great cities in the United States. New Orleans is no different. The recent economic development has attempted to disperse concentrations of poverty by relocating public housing residents in New Orleans is the same, New Orleans is the same, into different neighborhoods of cities. But the results are inconclusive as to whether those who are dispersed receive the benefits of what mixed-income communities were supposed to provide, greater equality of access to all those commodities that urbanites originally fled the inner city to achieve. Causes of what concentrates poverty are complex and are historic and are deeply rooted and seem not to change. Monique mentioned responses, and Professor Davis mentioned responses. What happens when the cameras go away? What happens when the Red Cross exhausts not its money, because I gather there's over $700 million of that in its coffers, but its ability to respond, because the Red Cross is in fact another first responder. The response to Katrina, the rediscovery of poverty in America, right now is an emergency response. It is an emergency response to those who notably have been dislocated, quote unquote, through no fault of their own because it is the result of natural disaster and emergency, and the cause and the effect are immediately obvious and very, very stark. They're what we used to call, with the exceptions that Professor Davis has been talking about, the worthy poor, those who are poor through no fault of their own. What will happen not only when the Red Cross exhausts its capabilities and its money, but when we exhaust our structure, our imagination to deal with the extent of this newly rediscovered poverty. The Red Cross's response is short term. It is zero sum. It doesn't address the structural homelessness, the structural joblessness, and the structural inadequacy of education, which was true for the residents of New Orleans who found themselves in the most difficult place, who could not leave, and which describes the residents of cities, whether they are the kind of city that concentrates poverty in its inner core or cities that disperse poverty to the periphery. What the Red Cross can do right now, and what many generous people in this room across the nation are doing right now in their homes, in their churches, in their synagogues, in their mosques, is really more akin to its old-fashioned bed blankets and hot food charity. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it is short-term. The problem with charity, which has a very long history in the United States, is that it views poverty as time-limited. It views it as caused by personal circumstances that can be individually overcome. It views it as the result of short-term disaster. the long-term structural relief of poverty is something that we have not had as part of the national agenda for a very long time. This is why we have to rediscover it every 25, 30 to 50 years. Let me give you an example of a problem with a short-term response which has an impact on long-term relief. The Department of Housing and Urban Development ordered last week that all public authorities, public housing authorities, put evacuees at the top of their waiting lists for public housing units and for vouchers. In the District of Columbia, and I read yesterday in the paper that the District of Columbia Housing Authority will begin implementing this already as it is required to do, this means that the 18,000 residents who've been waiting for 5 to 10 years on the waiting list for public housing and for vouchers in DC go to the bottom of the list. Whose poverty do you decide to relieve? Who decides who gets to live in your city? The problem, of course, with this response is that it's a zero-sum game with a finite number of units, finite number of vouchers, and in some ways this describes the way that we've been looking at our response to poverty. Monique mentioned the problem with the reconstruction of New Orleans. Successful disaster relief combines economic development with reconstruction. Local residents do the building, local residents are trained to do the reconstruction. Residents receive not really short-term jobs, but maybe a jump start on careers. This is true economic development. As Monique noted, prevailing wage rules for the reconstruction of New Orleans will not apply. This is a law called the Davis-Bacon Law, and it says in the construction phrase, it's quite explicit. Persons who work on projects over a certain dollar value must be paid the prevailing wage, which even in New Orleans is, I believe, 2 to 3 times what the minimum wage is. The residents of New Orleans who were displaced and who may or may not be able to come back, is well known that, by and large, those of them who are members of minority groups are poorly educated. By and large, they're insufficiently skilled to perform anything but service jobs. But construction jobs were a traditional way out and a way up for persons who did not have traditional or fairly sophisticated literacy skills. The suspension of Davis-Bacon, which is cynical and opportunistic, cuts off what could be in the next 2 to 5 years, very significant avenue of relief for residents of New Orleans. Everyone hates concentration of poverty. It's remarkable to me that no one complains about concentration of wealth. The example of San Francisco shows that a city can isolate itself just as easily by concentrating wealth and ignoring the value of diversity as it can by concentrating poverty. I think the true problem with wealth and its distribution in America is that many things have become commodified. New Orleans shows us you can buy your way out of inequality. You can buy your way out of public education. You can buy your way out of public transportation. You can buy your way out of public libraries, just click on Amazon. You can buy your way out of public hospitals. You can buy your way out of public parks and playgrounds. Until we reach an understanding that these essential services are not simply commodities that should be bought and sold, but in fact are human rights, I think we will see inequalities of wealth and poverty, and we will see more New Orleans. More of New Orleans. I think the final commodification, this is my sort of exhortation to you, is that of legal services. Legal services, one more thing that's bought and sold. I think you've got to ask yourselves who you're going to serve as lawyers. What are you going to do about these concentrations of wealth and poverty? What will you do as lawyers? And what will you do as citizens?
Some discussion of citizenship and how issues of race and class and citizenship interact with one another as we look at what happened in New Orleans and what continues to happen today. There's been a lot of discussion about the use of the term refugee to describe the victims of Katrina. Some have suggested that as a matter of international law, the correct term is not refugee, but instead internally displaced persons. Others have rejected the use of the term refugee on its own without suggesting that there's some other term that's correct, but instead there's something that's deficient, perhaps even offensive, about the use of the term refugee to describe people who were long-term residents, often done for generations in New Orleans. Now, this is where I want to start. Now, ultimately, what I want to argue to you is that neither term, refugee nor internally displaced person, is fully satisfying. Let me start by looking very briefly at the law. Refugees, as many of you know, are protected by a well-defined body of international law and conventions, much of which has been incorporated into U.S. domestic law. And typically, refugees are entitled to food, shelter, and a place of safety in the host country. In contrast, there is no international legal instrument protecting the rights of internally displaced persons, or IDPs, as they're sometimes called. And therefore, there's no specific state obligation with regard to IDPs, although the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has issued a 30-point guiding principles document. Now, if we look at that document, about the most specific guidance that we can find is the following statement. Authorities have the duty and responsibility to assist returned and or resettled internally displaced persons to recover, to the extent possible, their property and possessions which they left behind or were dispossessed of upon their displacement. So it's stating that this is what authorities have a responsibility to do, but as is the case with so much in international law, particularly when there is no governing convention, this is portatory. There's nothing to enforce it. Well, as embodied then in both international instruments and U.S. law, refugees are persons who are outside of their country of nationality. In contrast, IDPs are generally understood to be persons within their country of nationality. So now we begin to see a correlation within the law of terminology with nationality, and nationality's more robust companion citizenship. What I want to suggest here is that the impulse to distinguish between refugees and IDPs is coming from two places. The first is from some portion of the human rights, international human rights lawyer community, who argue that there is in fact value of invoking the IDP framework, and that this is a way of arguing for obligations that the state does have to people in New Orleans and elsewhere. But the second, and I think the more powerful critique, is coming from those who were displaced in New Orleans, and particularly from members of the African-American community. What I want to do is take a look at what some of the opinions are that I have seen about the use of the term refugee. The objections have been made to use, and to try to understand how we start to understand those objections. So I want to read a few quotes with the caveat that these may not be representative, but they do express, I think, at least one view that has been prominently represented in the media. Here's a statement from a man named Tyrone McKnight, who is a New Orleans resident who was sitting in the convention center in Baton Rouge at the time he was interviewed. He said, quote, "The image I have in my mind of a refugee is people in a third world country. That's not me. I'm a law-abiding citizen who's working every day and paying taxes." Okay? Second, a young woman named Daphne Carr, who was interviewed in the Superdome. Quote, "I'm not a refugee, I'm an American," unquote. Here's another quote from a woman named Donna Jo Napoli, who's a linguistics professor at Swarthmore, and the LA Times contacted her to get her opinion as a linguist on the use of the term refugee and the appropriateness of it. She says, "Although there are ways in which their situation is parallel to a refugee situation, the fact is that they are our own people. They are not refugees," unquote. And lastly is a statement that was made by Diane Watson, who is a U.S. representative from California representing a very poor district in Los Angeles. She said, "These are American citizens, plus they are the sons and daughters of slaves," unquote. Well, how do we make sense of these comments? What is it that we should take from them? For one thing, it's clear that the correlation of refugee with non-citizens exists in both law and in popular understanding. But if we look closer, I think we can see that what's at stake is not just some jingoistic sense of being an American, but something far more substantive than that. The question of citizenship for African Americans, so shamefully addressed in Dred Scott and later the main force behind the Civil War, was resolved in a formal jury sense by the 14th Amendment. But I would argue, as many have before me, that as a factual or de facto matter, it remains heavily contested. Persistent racial discrimination, massive racial inequalities in wealth and status, hate crime, unconscionable levels of incarceration, voter disenfranchisement, as well as just the daily degradation and microaggression, can be understood as challenges to the full membership and belonging of African Americans. Katrina laid all this bare, and so when Representative Watson invokes the history of slavery, I think she's doing two things. First, she's highlighting the centrality of the struggle for citizenship to African American history and to the contemporary moment. And second, she's reminding us of how citizenship should be measured, not merely in formalistic terms, do you have a passport, but by the lived experience of individuals and communities. By this account, Katrina exposed how degraded the citizenship of many African Americans continues to be. We might also extend this analysis to suggest how would we consider the citizenship of poor white people, whether in Louisiana or elsewhere? Are they fully citizens? When we think about citizenship, can we think beyond just what does your piece of paper say, what does your document say, but what else is carried with citizenship in terms of status, in terms of membership or belonging, in terms of your ability to participate fully in the ways that others in society do? Well, let me turn now to this question of if we embrace a refugee non-citizen correlation, which is to say that refugees can't be U.S. citizens, refugees are only non-U.S. citizens, what is lost by this? Is anything lost by it? And I think there are three things that we should consider. First, there is a danger that our choice of language here, for good and important reasons, as I've just discussed, may inadvertently harden distinctions that exist among citizens and non-citizens and within the category of non-citizens. We can think about a hierarchy of terms used to describe citizens and non-citizens, what I would consider a hierarchy of status, rights, and worthiness. Professor Bennett mentioned the worthy poor as opposed to the unworthy poor. Here we might think about the worthy immigrant versus the non-worthy immigrant. In this hierarchy, I would place citizens at the top. Based on the discussion that I just engaged in, I would suggest that internally displaced persons come next, then refugees, then non-citizens, then foreigners, then aliens. If refugee is now a bad term, what does that say about these other categories? Refugees before Katrina were considered to be the good immigrants, the worthy immigrants, a variation of the worthy poor. If now refugee carries with it a negative connotation, what does that say about alien, a term that already connotes someone coming from a foreign planet, a term that is oftentimes correlated with criminality, border crossing in the middle of the night, a threat to stability in our society? Second, how do we now think of refugees in other parts of the world if we have come to a conclusion that there are no refugees in the United States? Does this harden the line between the United States and the rest of the world in exactly the moment where we might be drawing closer together? There is a danger of further nativism, isolation, and exceptionalism when the U.S. already has too much of each of these. Third, if we adopt an internally displaced person framework, one that appears to rely upon nationality or citizenship, what then do we make of the rights of non-citizens who were also displaced by Katrina? And here, because of the very nature of displacement, displacement carries with it dispersal, there is an inevitable invisibility to many of the people who were affected by Katrina. And here I want to, without taking anything away from the stories of the majority of people from New Orleans and elsewhere who were displaced, look at some who haven't even registered on the radar screen. And in particular, I'm looking at certain immigrant communities. There were 30,000 Vietnamese refugees in Louisiana, about half of whom seem to have taken refuge in Texas. Note here the irony, refugee upon refugee. People who sought refuge from Vietnam, in large part because of U.S. involvement in Vietnam, who landed in Louisiana and now are forced to take refuge again. Are these internally displaced persons? 40,000 Hondurans were forced from their homes in the New Orleans area. There were 9,600 Salvadorans living in the area, according to the government of El Salvador. Where are they now? There were tens of thousands of Mexicans living in the New Orleans area. Many of these immigrants were undocumented. Are these internally displaced persons? Are they refugees? What do we do with them? How does our government respond to them? Well, let's look to see what FEMA says. FEMA has very thoughtfully posted on their website a Q&A for undocumented individuals. Question. In English, by the way. If I am an undocumented immigrant, am I eligible for assistance for needs related to the recent storms, tornadoes, and flooding? Answer. Listen closely. Yes. Really? You may be eligible under many different programs run by state and local agencies and volunteer agencies for various types of assistance. Please contact the American Red Cross, Catholic Charities Farm Workers Ministry, Lutheran Services of Florida. Even those of you who have yet to take a first year exam and engage in issue spotting can tell that FEMA, where the F stands for federal, is saying, yes, you qualify for things that we don't offer. Please do consult with your state or local government or these agencies who are engaging in the charity work that the government has failed to do itself. Short answer, you are not qualified for cash assistance from FEMA, which may be the most important source of assistance right now. Now, it does go on, to be fair, to say that undocumented immigrants may qualify for certain non-cash forms of relief, particularly counseling. And I don't mean to minimize that. We could spend the rest of the afternoon talking about what the mental health consequences of this disaster are for people in the area. But the point is that this is bringing out yet another structural inequality. The reason that FEMA can't offer anything here is not because of anything owing specifically to the incompetence of FEMA. There are plenty of other examples of that. But because of the fact that U.S. federal law refuses to countenance the fact that there are undocumented immigrants here who are making productive contributions, even as we exist in this parallel world where the business community understands fully that much of the country would collapse if undocumented workers were not here. Let me note parenthetically something that Professor Bennett mentioned and Monique mentioned on the phone, which is that even though it took days for the administration to recognize the gravity of the situation in the aftermath of Katrina, they were very quick to suspend the Davis-Bacon Act of 1931. That was enacted in the Great Depression. And as Professor Bennett noted, it requires a payment of prevailing wage to workers on certain federal contracts. Driving into work this morning, I heard Tony Blankley, who's the editorial page editor of the Washington Times and the radio, say something about how the Davis-Bacon Act does is it entitles workers to far more than they would get if it weren't for this law. Well, that's not right. What it does is that entitles them to the prevailing wage in the area. Okay? The prevailing wage for construction work in New Orleans is about $9.25 an hour. Louisiana is one of the states in the country that lacks its own minimum wage law, so it just adopts federal minimum wage, which is $5.15 an hour. So people remember the Kevin Bacon movie Footloose? Stick with me. Mark, you know that. So in the aftermath of Katrina, the administration was amazingly flat-footed in coming up with a response. But in suspending the Davis-Bacon Act, I think that they have enacted the Kevin Bacon Act. Footloose
shoes and fancy free and suspending the rights of workers. One more here, just because I can't resist. I don't want to mention that the hurricane ripped off the roof of the Superdome and ripped off the roof of issues of race and class. Well, the administration, I think, has taken no time, has lost no time in ripping off workers when the opportunity presented itself. We can look at the speech that President Bush gave last night and look at what other opportunities are taken. Promoting vouchers for private schools, promoting so-called enterprise zones, a whole litany of practices. Now, one thing that Paul Krugman noted in the New York Times today is that not everything that's being proposed by the administration is bad, right? Because those in New Orleans who have a stage worth more than $1.5 million can expect a tax break. So the point here, though, is that there is a continuing attack going on. And where does this leave us then? Professor Davis spoke about lawlessness. I think that what Katrina has done is to expose the failure of law. Not because law wasn't there, not because of lawlessness, but because of lawfulness, because of law's historic hostility to poor people, because of law's antipathy to racial equality. It's not only the attacks on the welfare state that were seen largely in the context of welfare reform starting in 1996, but attacks on affirmative action, a broad range of structural programs that were designed to address the types of inequality that we see so clearly in the aftermath of Katrina that were dismantled systematically in the last 25 years. What then do we do? And my time is essentially up, so I just want to make two brief suggestions. Well, one is a recourse, if not to the IPP framework, then to other human rights frameworks, specifically a framework of economic, social, and cultural rights. Whether we invoke that in the United States, or we invoke it in other fora, that is a framework that gets us beyond what I see as the fairly limited context of citizen and non-citizen specific frameworks of law. I'm skeptical of how far that gets us. I embrace the aspiration of economic, social, and cultural rights as part of US law. I'm skeptical of how receptive others will be to that. Well then, what else is available to us? Here I would suggest a recourse to politics, a dynamic politics that recognizes the different claims to citizenship of African Americans, of poor whites, of immigrants, but that does not put them in competition with one another. In a politics that deepens our empathy and our commitments, not only to those here in the United States, but to those who are marginalized the world over. Thanks.
A lot of food for thought. I know that there are immediate questions. We had two of our panelists have to speak and have to leave in 5 minutes, and so we'll ask questions quickly. Tim.
Professor Bennett made a comment about a question of who gets to decide who relocates to New Orleans. It appears to me the federal government's already started making that decision. Last night, the president outlined as one of his three ways to rebuild the city with the Urban Homesteader Act that he wants to have. And the way he described it was that federal land would be identified and given to for free of charge to people who wanted to return to New Orleans. But the two criteria were that you can get a mortgage and build on it. So that wipes out most of the people that live in this place.
That's interesting. It makes me think of, I was just reading the other day about the residents, the free black residents of Southeast DC, who during Reconstruction were, thanks to the Freedmen's Bureau, the only black residents of D.C. were actually able to acquire property. That didn't last very long. I didn't hear that. I'm going to have to read up on it about this new homestead idea. But it is clear that not just having the means to get the means is going to be a problem. I think the Fed actually released a study not too long, the other day, which showed that the incidence of it's not quite lending, it is lending discrimination. Those who are black at all income spectrums seem to receive mortgages and refinancing that are 2 to 3 times more expensive than those who are white. So there continues to be credit discrimination against even African Americans and persons of other ethnicities who are not of modest means. So I think this is going to be, this may be a fantasy.
Also related to Bush's speech last night, I was wondering if any of the panelists would comment on the statement he made, quote, "Within the Gulf region, there are some of the most beautiful historic places in America. As all of us saw on television, there is also some deep, persistent poverty in this region as well. That poverty has roots in a history of racial discrimination, which cut off generations from the opportunity of America. We have a duty to confront this poverty with bold action."
That was so interesting.
I call on somebody who wrote that.
I was not and the reason being that I think that he had to say something about race, and if we listen closely to what he said is consistent with his administration and prior Republican administration's approach to race generally, which is to place it in a historical context. Its roots are in racial discrimination. But there is no contemporary practice that is cognizable to them that perpetuates, exacerbates, or in any way affects it. And so I think that we should look at that comment, evaluate that context, for example, in the context of affirmative action, right? It's now too late to talk about O'Connor stepping down because there's so much else that's going on, but one of the things that really shocked me about the discussion around O'Connor stepping down was that she was pro-affirmative action. And if we look at the Grutter and Gratz decisions around affirmative action in higher education, one could draw the conclusion. But if we look to see who was the main architect of the dismantling of affirmative action programs in the Adirondack case and in others in the late 80s and early 90s, it was Justice O'Connor. And that distinction, again, the ability to be anti-affirmative action there and pro-affirmative action in the context of higher education, I think depends upon placing racial inequality in this kind of historical context without recognizing contemporary practices that I would be shocked if the president had recognized those, but I do think that he had to say something about this.
And just very briefly, I also think that there is no recognition or understanding of unconscious racial feelings or unconscious racism because a clear understanding of historical racism because it was stark, it was open, it was intentional, overt, easy to see, and if there's a will there, easier to eliminate, although not easy. With unconscious racism, which is why Laura Bush was outraged that anyone would suggest that race has something to do with it, because it is a subconscious, unconscious view based on stereotypes and everything else, and no one is dealing with that. I'm happy to hear that at least some of the media are starting to talk about it for the very first time, but it is, I think, the basis of the foundation of our racial problems today, and no one's really addressing it.
Mark? I want to pick up on the quote that Julia read and a couple things that Angela and Munir just said. Munir, to add to this whole O'Connor thing, I have a similar response in terms of O'Connor becoming William Brennan when she retired, which wasn't the way I view O'Connor as a lawyer growing up. She also wrote the majority opinion in Rithman versus Croson, which was maybe the first Supreme Court opinion, big one that came out when I was in law school, sort of changed my entire way of viewing the Supreme Court after that. So, yeah, way to get it. President Clinton, Angela, basically mentioned unconscious racism today on the Today Show, talking about sort of stuff in a relatively effective way. And so that's, in terms of the quote, I really agree with Munir in terms of it not being surprising. It did shock me for a moment away from researching for my fantasy football league team this weekend. I turned and I looked at the television and I said, oh my God, I can't believe it. And then what it sounded to me like was what somebody Clarence Thomas might have said in the Supreme Court case, that to acknowledge the fact of racism in this historical context. But the question then becomes, what's the bold action that comes afterwards? And the bold action is leave no child behind. The bold action is empowerment zones or whatever, and this notion that you mentioned of, hey, we're going to give everybody property here on federal land, but only people have enough money to buy it in the first place. So it's one thing to acknowledge it, it's another thing altogether to do it. I guess the question I want to ask all of you, and sort of my response to all this, and maybe I'm too cynical about this as I increasingly get older, the notion that you started off with, Hadar, about this blowing the roof off, this notion of or sort of the shield over poverty and race in the country. I mean, did this really do that? I mean, are there really that many people who didn't know that there were lots and lots, thousands and thousands of poor black people in this country? It seems to me what this did and the sort of discomfort that this created for Americans, for most Americans, wasn't so much that they now realize that they're poor black people, but quite genuinely and understandably, not so much that they're poor, but that in this country, and again, when you're in the, you kept hearing that as opposed to other countries, that people could be in this place, the Civic Center, the Superdome, for 3 or 4 days without getting any sort of food altogether. I didn't hear the corollary necessarily that, oh, and it's unbelievable that these are people who don't have enough money to get out of the city or enough this, enough that. Maybe I'm wrong, but I get the sense that the response is going to be one about FEMA and how we deal with disaster relief, much less if it's going to be an attempt to really address these underlying issues of poverty. Because if there really are people who didn't know about these poverty issues before now, I mean, I don't really know who they are, because I think most people did. Certainly the people in the media did. They just weren't forced to talk about it, as Angela suggested this time, that they were. So I don't know. I mean, does anyone think that I am too cynical or that there is this hope here for the future?
Thank you. Way in the back.
I had a general question about how people are holding state and local governments accountable. Because FEMA hasn't made a secret that you're supposed to be able to be self-sustainable for 2 to 3 days before they can get in. So the fact that New Orleans locally just fell apart in hours, how much of this is falling down on regulations and how much is coming down on FEMA? Clearly, they both screwed up dramatically, but it seems to me like all the blame is being shifted over to FEMA, and I don't think it's realistic for us to expect that we have a lack of response in the case of a natural disaster.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure lots of blame to go around. I'm certainly not one to say, oh, Ray Nagin did everything all right, and Governor Blanco did. I'm sure they all screwed up in various ways, you know. I don't know, and I guess the truth will come out about who did what and all that later. All I know is that regardless of what Ray Nagin did or did not do before Monday, the 29th of August, as of the morning of the 30th, George Bush, Michael Brown, Chertoff, all those people knew that people were drowning and dying. And they had the ability, you know, as in the resources, to save their lives. I know I'm sounding overly simplistic, but, you know, they saw the images, they knew what was going on. If they didn't know, shame on them. You know, and so why weren't they saved is all I have to say. I mean, you know, Ray Nagin is up on the, you know, he didn't have the resources. Should he have had them? Should he have done something? Probably so. But at that point, what are they going to do? Say, oh, no, it's Ray Nagin's thing. It's Blanco's thing. I'm staying here out on the ranch. And when people are dying, I mean, FEMA has that responsibility. And clearly, there's all this bureaucracy and arguing over whether she empowered the National Guard. And that was her fault. And there's all of them at fault. But my point is that the federal government had the resources to save the lives of those people. And they could have, don't tell me if they can get over to Iraq in 12 hours that they can't get down the road to New Orleans. And I don't care about the red tape and the bureaucracy and all that. They had the ability to do it, and they could have done it. And they didn't have the will, apparently. And that says something really deeply shocking to me about, you know, racism, yes, I will say it, and about their concern about poor people. I just think it is just that simple, and they can deny it all they want, but I see it that way.
This actually goes back to a short conversation Professor Bender and I had at one point. She said she sees everything in terms of class, and I said I'm starting to see everything in terms of race.
I said gender,
and that was what my question was going to be about. You're talking about re-involving people in building the city. I've been involved in construction work, but it's not a female profession.
Where are women?
Why is it?
There are not women involved. In
oh, I see. That there are not women.
Where are women going to be involved in rebuilding when we're talking about a lot of female head households, and we're talking about a lot of women who are employed in means that maybe aren't regulated or taxable by the government, home daycare, stuff like that, and women are obviously I'm assuming the majority of the victims of the violent sexual crimes that are going on now there. How do we involve women in the rebuilding?
I think, first of all, someone's going to have to want to. And I think that is, who will have the will to decide that the persons who were involved, and I'll say in low-wage work, either low-wage work because it was really low-wage work because they were in the service economy, or in jobs that were transient, didn't pay very well, or low-wage work because it was, you know, off the books, uncompensated. They were taking care of their kids, they were taking care of other people's kids, whatever. All the contributors to the economy of New Orleans, as diverse in many ways as it was, who's going to make the decision that those economies are worth reviving and reviving better than they were? Actually, I don't know the answer to that question. I truly, truly don't. One would think that a vibrant economy would be based on vibrant neighborhoods which would have businesses that would meet a variety of needs. That is any urban planner's definition of a healthy neighborhood and a healthy city. Some places they just grow, not too many. Other places they have to be created. And who is going to have the vision and the idealism, I think, to recreate that kind of diverse economy that will accommodate all? I do not know where you start, and it is such a complicated question that we are all, I think any of us who think about this, terribly concerned and terribly worried that there are others who don't think it's a complicated question at all.
I apologize for having to leave, but thank you very much for having me.
About 5 more minutes on questions, and then we want to turn to some concrete ideas, really brainstorming about things that we as a community can be doing.
I'm wondering about the effects of implementing the new bankruptcy laws, and how that would affect the development. I mean, those laws were specifically enacted to make it harder for poor people to achieve relief.
This is fascinating. One senator, I do not recall who, I'm sorry, is already, and this is actually what some of the folks who are now, I think, legislators were beginning to regret some of the legislative decisions they've made over the past couple of weeks or months, or this is giving them cause. One legislator has proposed amending the bankruptcy law even before it takes effect in order to exempt those who want to file for bankruptcy who are from areas which were declared disaster relief or whatever. So it'll be interesting. It's another worthy poor provision. If you can prove that Katrina was the cause of your financial difficulty, I guess maybe you'll get to file Chapter 7 under the old law. I don't know. But that is one proposal. And I think that I'm blanking on another one I heard that would create a specific exemption in some otherwise very ill-considered legislation for victims of Katrina. I think this is a great example of stacking up different kinds of misfortune, I guess, against each other and seeing this as a zero-sum game, and I think it's problematic. I'm not saying that these folks shouldn't get an exemption. I'm saying that the legislation was rather poorly considered in the first place.
A lot of what's, I guess, being discussed or not being discussed enough now is basically not whether or not or to what scale the federal government's going to respond. It's how it's responding, how it's structuring its response. First of all, they passed a bill without any discussion, giving a ton of money to FEMA to help with reconstruction, which FEMA is an emergency management organization. They're not a reconstruction organization. I think that their, their credibility as a functioning organization in general has been seriously questioned. But the other thing that happened this week is that Bush announced that his reconstruction coordinator was going to be his chief political strategist and message massager, Karl Rove, who And it just it seems to call into question that, you know, after this response and after the initial kind of lack of response from the president, we were all kind of waiting for that bullhorn moment, you know, where he's at ground zero and he says, you know, I hear you very soon, you know, the world will hear you, etc. And it's, we keep seeming to wait for this, but yet they started this process by which they're going to be allowed to give nobody contracts. They've already started giving them. They put someone who has absolutely no experience in managing this type of operation in charge. They're basically, it's no secret that their response to this, if, you know, the people that are talking about how they're responding to it, they see it as a political crisis, not as a way of reconstructing the, you know, the country. They're taking pages out of the Heritage Foundation's book as far as, you know, what society in New Orleans should look like from this point on. They're creating these communities of mobile homes instead of you know, going, you know, taking advantage of the Section 8 like voucher system to help people kind of rebuild their lives and rebuild their homes. And, you know, that type of, they've been using HUD, but they've gutted HUD, so that's not even an effective organization. Anyway, so my point is, you got a president who will turn the power on for a grid in New Orleans in order to make his speech, and as soon as he flies, he turns the power back off. And he treats, like, you know, each thing he does as a photo opportunity as opposed to actually rebuilding the community. How does this affect not only the people on the ground who are trying to get their lives back together, but how does it affect us who want to help? And we seem to be coming at odds with the federal government's, you know, response to their vote.
Are you registered to vote?
Oh, sure. I think that they have three political problems. One is the perception based in reality that they were woefully inadequate in the response, and they're trying to deal with that. And Roe comes with that because, you know, his advisor is right there. The second political problem they have is within their own party, because you're right, they have Congress already allocated about $60 billion. People are talking about the total budget for reconstruction being somewhere in the range of $200, $300, $400 billion. For a year, we're talking about a budget that exceeds the budget for the war in Iraq. And that's the, you know, the giant elephant in the room. I was mentioned the fact that we've got this other major project sorts going on. So there's a political problem within the Republican Party, because the fiscal conservatives are balking at the idea of spending so much money. Now, those are problems that Roe can deal with. There's a third problem, which I think implicates us in a much more direct way. Those who are concerned about what our government does to address issues of structural inequality. And that's the political problem of the main thrust of the Republican Party over the last 30 years, which has been a kind of starved-for-beast approach. I mean, you've heard this terminology, but essentially, starting with Reagan, this notion that we need a smaller government, is a way of saying, let's starve the government so that there's less that the government can do to interfere in business interests, among other things. And I think that one of the lessons that I see coming out of Katrina is that when you starve the beast, it doesn't die right away. When you starve the beast, the first thing it does is start to feed on its own. And that's what happened in New Orleans. And I think that there's a moment here that is going to close pretty quickly. To argue over what the main thrust, the trajectory of the last 30 years of governance by Republicans has given, to cut taxes, which means that local governments have to take on doing more with less, going back to the question that was asked before, to say that this is about, to frame things in terms of moral responsibility rather than looking at questions of distribution of wealth. And people have bought it. Look at the electoral victories that have taken place. It's an attractive rhetoric in a lot of ways. And I think that Katrina has exposed the gap between the rhetoric and reality. And there's a moment now for, I think, a much more robust consideration of the starve-the-beast approach. And the one thing, you know, it's just last point, I know we want to move on, but I think the day after or 2 days after Katrina struck, the action that the Congress was supposed to take up, the Senate had it on its agenda, was to extend and make permanent the elimination of the estate tax, something that benefits a few thousand people in a country of 280 million. And Republicans have a good political sense to take that off the agenda. Well, I wish they kept it on, because that would have made stark contrast. Giveaways to the wealthiest few thousand people in the country of 280 million at the expense of paying attention to Katrina. Even though that didn't happen, that essentially I think is a contrast that politically needs to be drawn.
The other item on that legislative agenda was to be able to cut $10 billion from the Medicaid program. And that is one that actually worries me a great deal even more, because that is less on the radar screen of most folks in America, because we don't think about Medicaid, because most of us don't have to think about being poor. Many of us don't think about being uninsured, and that is changing. More and more people are unfortunately in that category. But that's an easier one to slip by, because the death tax debate has gotten so much publicity that it may be noticed if in fact that's reintroduced. The $10 billion cut in Medicaid won't be noticed.
There is so much more to discuss substantively. When I did say about ripping the roof off of the Superdome and ripping the roof off of a discussion of race and class, it's not because these aren't things that we know exist. They're things we don't talk about. They're things that we don't see on the front page of the Washington Post every day. Right now, we have a small window to do so many things. If we as individuals, we as community groups, we as lawyers, we as law students come together and really think about what change we want to see happen. We have roles to play, and it's important for us to realize that this is not only something that happened down in the Gulf states. This morning, I went with a group of 11 students on a pontoon trip. It was going to be a canoe trip, but it was a pontoon trip along the Anacostia River Basin. We saw and explored and heard about and saw and witnessed the toxic dumping into the river, the way that pollutants come down into the river basin and into the watershed region, the plans for development along the waterfront, and the ways that it's affecting communities, predominantly poor communities of color, just across the river. All of these things that we are talking about in terms of redevelopment, in terms of creating community, in terms of looking at how we want our society to be, because really that's what we come down to when we're talking about, you know, this moment of reinvention or of reconstruction, whatever you like to call it, has overtones and has direct implications not only in Louisiana and Mississippi and other affected regions, but even here in our own community in Washington, D.C. It's very important that we keep that in mind. It's very important that as we think about and talk about all of these issues, all of our speakers today, all four of them, talked about a variety of very specific human rights issues. This is the first of a variety of conversations that I'm sure that we'll be having not only this semester, but through the course of the year and through the course of the next few years, as we think about and talk about and act on what needs to happen in this country regarding race, class, and human rights. So at this point, I want to thank our speakers very much. I also want to thank our co-sponsors for today's event. There were more than 11 organizations and offices, and I neglected to mention them in the beginning, and I don't have the full list, but we want to thank them as well. For their quick sponsorship, and to our speakers for very quickly coming up with thoughtful and important things to say. At this point, we want to move the conversation into a much more concrete mode to talk about what we as a community can be doing. We have about 10 minutes, and I'm going to actually have to step out at that point, too, because I have to catch a plane. And Professor Bennett has a client waiting for her, so thank you for staying later. It's interesting you say, because many of you actually wrote up your remarks. I was going to ask you actually for your remarks after we put them up on the Senate's website. That's great, and we should have them up by some point next week. I don't know if Marika's still here. That's great. So we'll coordinate that in terms of having resources up on the Center's website.
I'll see Jonathan Carl's all tonight at 7, Politics and Prose. I can't be here, but you should. Jonathan Kozol wrote a fabulous book called Seven Minute Qualities and many others. He's a politics and prose in his
Politics and prose at Connecticut, Nebraska.
He's a friendly person who booked me. You don't have to buy it. Come here and talk.
Don't everybody leave.
Yeah.
I just want to say,
on the table with all of the various materials. There's a flyer for an event that we'll be holding on Monday afternoon at 5 o'clock in room 603 in conjunction with the UNRO Impact Litigation Clinic called The Implications for Human Rights When Indigenous Populations Are Forcefully Displaced from Their Homeland. Yet another really catchy, sexy title. Rolls right off the top. It's going to be a panel discussion and movie screening about one of the clients at the UNRO clinic is representing in his and their class action case against the U.S. government for being forcibly displaced for the creation of a military base in the Chagos Islands, right?
And we will be here.
And the plaintiff will actually be here, first time in the U.S., and he will be speaking as well as showing a film about kind of reality on the ground there. If you can come, it's in room 603 at 5 o'clock on Monday. It will kind of take us into another level of this conversation. While not directly related, it has a lot to inform this discussion and our thinking. Thank you very much for the plug. I had it right here. That's good. So at this point, Lauren, do you want to run this part of this conversation in terms of brainstorming? And I put you on the spot just because it all of us changed our clothes very quickly from the canoe trip. So,
I don't know if everybody saw outside, we came up with a list of possible ways to get involved, things you can do to help out, but we kind of wanted to have a brainstorming session after this panel because it feels like everybody's kind of just sitting around and talking. They're talking a lot and they're criticizing and they're pointing fingers, but what's really being done? Isn't that our whole criticism of the whole thing, is that nothing is actually, you know, being done to help people? Well, not that nothing is being done, but that not enough is being done. So what can we do here, sitting in our classroom, sitting in Washington College of Law, to do something? Do we want to do something? We've had bake sales, we've had raffles, we've had bar review last night, and all that many points to the Red Cross. But do we want to do more of that? Do we feel like fundraising is something we can do from Washington, D.C.? There are people from New Orleans, there are students from New Orleans here in this school, I don't know if anybody's here today, but there's also the Armory, which is over at the Indian Falls Church, has a bunch of people from New Orleans and Mississippi being sheltered, and they're in need of a lot of assistance in terms of driving people from, from the store to the shelter, people don't have cars, and in terms of, bringing clothes, bringing food, bringing water, all kinds of stuff. So there's things close by that we can do, but are you interested? Do you want to do those things? And what kind of ideas do people have? So we thought we'd have a brainstorming session. Yes.
I love the whole fundraising thing. I really do. And I helped out with the bake sale, and whenever people ask for money, I look at my wallet. But at this point, it seems to me that that we can keep doing that, and I think the money's going to get to people who need it. But at this point, I'm just kind of still processing this information about Carl Rove being put charge. And it just seems that the federal government insists on making this a political issue. And so, while I think that there's a relief aspect to this that we need to kind of be visible, there's also now a political issue too, and I think that for myself, the responsibilities I feel like I have now because I care, it is I have to be aware of what's going on. I have to be informed, number one. I have to you know, I feel like if someone's out there spouting misinformation, I feel like I need to correct them, you know. But also, I feel like since the politicians are now involved, and there's these whitewash investigation committees that are being formed that obviously might have more of the, I guess, the goal of making sure everyone survives this politically, as opposed to finding out the truth. I do think that there's letter writing and this phone call and postcards, stuff like that, that we could possibly be interested in students involved and it wouldn't require a whole lot of effort.
Okay. There's definitely a
fact we're
here in Washington, D.C.
Yes, I think that it's very important to think about the fact, well, I'm from Louisiana, so I had it important for me. Think about the effect that it's having on the state. Like, my state is essentially going to become a third world country if it keeps going the way it is. And it upsets me so much that I just want to cry this entire time. Like, things that Louisiana needs right now is housing. You know, like, let's get some housing, like, the joint habitat for humanity, go build some houses. Like, Louisiana doesn't have, the Louisiana outlying towns don't have the capacity to hold these people. Lafayette is the third largest town in Louisiana, and it only has 150,000 people in it. You put 150,000 more people in it, and it stops functioning. Like, I can't call my parents because their phone lines don't work. You know, like, my parents go to the gas station, and there's not gas there. They go to Walmart, and there's no bread. Like, that's the real problem. You want to know what the real problem is? Like, go to Lake Charles, go to Baton Rouge, you know, go to these cities like Monroe or Shreveport in Louisiana or in Houston, where all these people are opening up their arms to these evacuees. You know, because obviously that's the right thing to do, but, you know, Louisiana government is so corrupt and so inefficient and bureaucratic that we just don't have the supplies. And, you know, it's all great. Let's build New Orleans. I am all for it. I love the town. It's 4 years there. But the thing that made the town was the people and the culture. And remaking it into something it's not, I hope just change the name, because it should be New Orleans, if you ask me. But, I mean, I think that it's really important to look into those areas that are being hard hit by the evacuees. And, you know, people can't live in a like, people are living in a place like my pantry. Like, people can't live there. You know, like, getting housing, like,
and Mississippi too, and you know, not in Louisiana, but there were other states and other cities.
So if we could look and see where people are going, like, you know, I'll definitely help the need to, like, but, you know, donating to Habitat for Humanity or volunteering time or anything that's about.
We're planning an alternative spring break over spring break. We want to go down to the area, but and there was some talk about perhaps trying to go down over winter break, but problem came into is that too soon. If we take groups of students down, we're more just going to be weighing on everybody and taking more resources than actually helping.
Yeah, so I don't think
definitely are trying to finish it, but definitely something like Habitat or Humanity or doing construction work, something like that, but maybe we're gonna think about waiting until spring break. Then we can
raise adopting a family or something and raising money to like get them a house or
we need contact like
right. I mean, I can help out. Like, I can see if my mom can volunteer anything that can help her. But I think that it would be really nice if, you know, I know with the 1L, like, each section could adopt a family, and then, you know, with the upperclassmen, they could, you know, join groups and, like, adopt a family and try to raise money in that group and, you know, provide for them something substantial, like a house for them to live in. You know, not just, like, oh, here's a sweatshirt.
Okay, I know
the
I can introduce Jamie Dunchick from the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, who just wants to say something about some of the stuff that they're doing. But before that, because I do have to run out, one suggestion that I would make is that we connect with some of the direct service organizations, not the big organizations like the American Red Cross, which isn't doing important work, so it's not necessarily getting to all the people that you were just talking about. When Monique said that, you know, one of the biggest misconceptions or discrepancies, the gap between what we see on the news versus what's really happening is this idea that everyone's getting help, everyone has shelter, everybody's evacuated in Louisiana. It's not true, and we know that it's not true, and there are specific organizations that we know are helping directly. So I would hope that
fundraise.
So that if we fundraise, we fundraise to support some of those organizations.
And we have the list on here.
you have a list. We have a very short list of what are, you know, there are a lot more organizations, but this is a very quick time frame that we pulled this thing together, were the ones that we could come up with. But so that a focus of our energies also go towards those organizations.
Okay.
Okay? I got it wrong.
Thank you
all
for coming. Do you want to say something to that
people? Thanks, Jamie. I'm sorry.
I didn't want to interrupt if anybody was talking to this past time. I work for a nonprofit civil rights law firm and I've been with STAR and other things, and so kind of using this as a pitch to let you guys know sort of the connection that we were trying to make is our organization is looking at possible litigation against FEMA, and then also in specific areas that we foresee is coming out of this, which we're not specifically touched on, I think, by some of the panelists, but more of the unconscious type of racism that's going to come out of this. We foresee, well, it's already been talked about, that Texas, either the school districts or the state itself, is applying for provisions to No Child Left Behind because the students that they're accepting aren't exactly going to raise their test scores in any way. So how is that going to affect the even displaced students as well as students in Texas? Making sure we're trying to take a correct response to make sure that minority-owned businesses are in some way, you know, receiving some of these federal billions of dollars of contracts. And then a lot of housing issues, we definitely are trying to show that the government and any other sort of situation has been able to provide opportunity for low-income communities and everything else that they're not doing in this situation, which again affects or speaks to racism in this issue. And the new issue that's come out that we're pretty hot on right now is the unprecedented use of criminal background checks, which has never been done before, never been delivered to the public, and has now been opened because of, again, the population that people are accepting into their homes. So Adar actually has my contact information. I'm going to be in contact with her next week, and we will hopefully get an email out to the law students about if this is something that interests you, using your legal minds as resources rather than your money and your cookies and everything else, then we would love to have you as work with the Lawyers Committee.
That's similar.
Okay, so there's a ton of nonprofits in the city, but for the Lawyers Committee Civil Rights, you can go to the website too and just check it out. But,
that's why.
Thank you.
That's all I can help.
Definitely.
We'll be
definitely. Okay. Yes. One thing I think. We have a pretty incredible resource if we do have 20,000 of these evacuees living here. We've been talking about how a lot of these solutions haven't been involving the community in them. And I think a perspective that maybe we haven't gotten enough of is what people who've been evacuated really want to have happen and involved in they've been. So perhaps even instead of just our maybe going and doing outreach to these people, perhaps bringing representatives from these evacuees here to the law school, have a panel talk to them about what kind of impact they want to have, where they want to direct their futures, and bringing that discussion more to the table. And I think that's okay. I would even say go to where they are. We don't have to bring them here. Well, I think that too, if just going to where they are maybe doesn't necessarily raise enough awareness within our community. I mean, if we go to where they are, that's an important message too, but by bringing people here, perhaps it'll make it more accessible for more people within our law community to hear something. Okay. Anything else on the agenda? Okay, so how many of you are interested in getting involved in something like this, or, you know, hoping to find evacuees or hoping to
idea. I know, I'm not sure if people's schedules are like, or, I mean, this is all sort of just spur of the moment, but obviously this, as Star said, is the beginning of a conversation that we want to keep having this year, and efforts and initiatives that we want to begin now that can continue. So if this is interesting to you in any way, politically, legally, charity, things like that, I mean, I think there's a lot of ways to go with this. So why don't you circulate a piece of paper, and if this is of interest to you, put your name and email address and sort of, you know, a particular thing, if they're what you've heard already, that would be a particular interest, and we will get in touch with you. But then this will be a discussion, but perhaps we can build a steering committee that, you know, the WCL will have for this year and beyond, and even link up with other law schools. So, I mean, our hope here is that this is just the start of something much bigger. And I think, you know, if you guys want to be part of that, you know, please sign up, and we'll be getting in touch with you.
Thank you.